This is Death Watch, the monthly podcast where we eulogize one of the greats who has recently passed by watching some of their work that we weren't previously familiar with. I am Matt Brown.
And I am Matthew Price.
We are the co-hosts of this Death Watch show. Today we're going to look at the career of one of the biggest...
That was perfectly rehearsed, by the
way. Thank you. Yeah, I know. Nailed it. One of the biggest stars in the history of American filmmaking who parlayed his success into cameo appearances not just on Beverly Hills 90210, but on also, yes, The Golden Girls. Mr. Burt Reynolds, as Blanche Devereaux would put it, who passed away of a heart attack on September 6th of this year at the ripe old age of 82. Let me walk you through how this show is going to go for anyone who's just joining us for the first time. We both watched Burt Reynolds movies. I watched Deliverance, you watched Hooper, is that right?
Correct. Yeah.
And after we've done a bit of a rundown of Mr. Reynolds' biography, we're going to talk about those movies.
Sure.
But first, actually, you know what? Before roll call,
yes,
it is also worth pointing out that as of the day after, this episode is dropping on the 26th of October, which means tomorrow is our birthday.
Oh, yeah.
We have been doing this show for a solid year.
Welcome to our 12th episode, everyone.
It's actually our 13th.
Oh, yeah, right, because the year.
One
of course,
in October.
Because then,
yeah.
Right, because there's no year zero.
That's right.
Okay,
yeah,
no, I understand.
It's exact.
Yeah.
There is no year zero.
Welcome to our 13th episode.
Yeah, and we're, you know, I hope you don't think it has sucked the whole time.
Why would you still be here?
Yeah,
why would you?
That would be insane.
Yeah. You're like, you're waiting for it to get good? This is
it. Guys, we plateaued on like episode 3.
Guys, this is the limit of what we are able to do. And we hope you like it. But if you think that we're going places,
No.
We are not.
We are in the places.
We are.
We have arrived.
We've checked into the library.
So with that said, it's time for roll call.
Hey, roll call. So this is my little corner of the show.
Yep.
Where I get to talk about who has passed away since we did the last show.
It is the only time we let you talk in the whole show. No.
Otherwise, I just sort of, I do it without permission.
Yeah, exactly.
Right. It's not like you can
shut me up. Unplug your mic.
I know. It's because of the fence.
Yep. We're both being physically restrained at all times. Otherwise, this show
I'm
would just
tied
be a
up
fist
in
fight.
A series of bungees.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. So let's talk about who died. I would say in a lucky way, it has been not to cast aspersions on any of the people who did pass away, but it has not been as eventful a month as some of the others.
It's true.
A relatively calm period in the field of people passing away.
Yeah.
So we will start with Joe Mastroff, who was a Broadway writer who wrote most famously the book for the musical Cabaret.
Ooh.
Where the Candor and Ebb musical. So
can you tell me, you're a musical guy?
I am.
The book versus the...
The book is all the words that people say. It's the play part of the musical as opposed to the musical parts. So within a musical, there is a play going on, and that someone needs to write that play. And
does the person who writes the book have musical experience?
Well, they need to be able...
Can I write a book is what I'm asking.
Any playwright, in theory, can do that work.
So no.
But you don't have any playwriting experience.
That's right.
But,
thank you.
But there are people who are better at it because you need to be able to have your scenes fit the fact that music is going to happen, right? Mm. So it's a bit more complicated than just writing a play in some ways because you are aligning with other creators more.
Okay.
Right? And wrote many things, but was most famous for Cabaret, which has a wonderful book. As musicals go, has a really strong plot, considering it comes from a bunch of disconnected short stories.
Right.
So there's that. Tara Farris, who was an Instagram model in Iraq and was shot, was murdered, and is one of many high-profile women who have been murdered in the last year in Iraq. There is actually I wanted to bring some attention to the fact there's actually a fairly organized campaign against women becoming independent by murdering ones that do so. It's quite awful.
Wow. Are they tracking them down specifically through Instagram? Or are they like trolling through Instagram?
Many,
to find
many different ways. But in this case, she rose to prominence that way. She was, an outspoken independent person who was very vocal on, primarily in the area of expression through fashion and style, but, you know, was a role model and was in her 20s. It was not a good situation.
No, that's awful.
It was. Charles Aznavour passed away, who was a French singer, exceptionally famous. Most people who are film people would know him because he played the lead in Shoot the Piano Player.
Oh.
And in a part that was essentially tailored to him. But he is really like the European equivalent of Frank Sinatra, a kind of absolute master stylist in the area of song interpretation, and also was a very credible actor, worked many years as an actor as well.
Hmm.
Peggy Sue Guerin Rackham, who is, in fact, that Peggy Sue, Buddy Holly's high school girlfriend.
Oh.
Passed away.
Wow.
Yeah.
I thought you were going to be like, got married?
No, she is the one who he wrote all the songs about.
Mm-hmm.
Jeff Emmerich, who was the recording engineer for many, many great records, but primarily known for being the recording engineer for the Beatles.
Mm.
So, along with George Martin, helped to actually create and define the sound of the Beatles, and especially through some of the more experimental records. So, a pivotal figure in music.
Cool beans.
A film editor, Mark A. Livolsi, who edited The Devil Wears Prada, the live-action Jungle Book, and the new upcoming live-action Lion King, died very prematurely.
Wow.
Yeah. But you can see from, I imagine that editing on a film like Jungle Book or Lion King is a whole other world of trying to assemble elements that aren't there yet and figure out cadences of scenes that aren't completely rendered and stuff. So
yeah, I'm always fascinated by that, you know, Pixar movies as well, just sort of like that. What is that workflow? How are you, you're essentially establishing rhythm, but like, what are you working with to do it? It's very opaque to me.
And how much of it is really editing as editorial? So saying, you know, we need this to go on a second longer so that this happens. So you go back and re-render a scene differently and, you know, go back to actual animators to do different performances. Right.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Audrey Wells, screenwriter and director. Her breakthrough was the movie The Truth About Cats and Dogs, which is a wonderful...
God, I love that movie.
Wonderful movie.
Yeah.
Most recently, she wrote the script for The Hate U Give.
No kidding.
Yeah, yeah. And again, died very young, like in, I believe, her 50s. A couple of very well-known character actors. So Scott Wilson.
Yeah.
Oh, man. So, I mean, most people, I guess, know him for In Cold Blood, or sorry, for The Walking Dead.
Yeah.
But Scott Wilson was in Cold Blood,
mm-hmm.
And you know, famously played one of the killers. And also, which you may have noticed, he's in The Right Stuff. He's one of the astronauts.
He sure is.
He's Scott Carpenter.
Yeah.
So. And then also just today, apparently, James Caron, another absolutely fantastic character actor who has too many credits to even list.
Yeah, it's madness.
But again, one of those, either of these folks, if you Google Scott Wilson or James Caron, their picture will come up and you will go, that guy.
Yeah.
Right? And too many of those, that guy's around. So, yeah.
Yeah, man.
And then... I'm not quite sure how upset I am about this, but it is something that happened. So we lost Will Vinton, which, see, you're making a face because you don't remember.
I don't know who Will Vinton
is. Will Vinton was an animator, primarily in the area of stop motion, and he was the person responsible for the California Raisins.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Weird.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
So, and
you don't know how upset you are about
among
that?
Many. I don't know if that's a big loss. I mean, the California Raisins is really cute, but it's
adorable,
you know. But anyway, there's that. Film producer Arnold Copelson,
yeah,
who, again, a guy with a million credits, all great.
Mm-hmm.
The producer of Platoon, The Fugitive,
yeah,
Outbreak, Seven, Eraser, and I found out by reading his IMDb, Porky's.
Yeah.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
So Porky's had quite the pedigree going.
He has a weirdly deep bench of very interesting movies. And also he's one of those guys who, you know, really was one of the last great producers of adult movies before they completely vanished.
Well, they didn't vanish. They just all moved to Netflix and became 12 episode series. But yeah.
But you know, like think about movies like again, The Fugitive or Outbreak or Seven and be like, oh yeah, movies that you like that you go to see as a 40-year-old.
Right.
You know.
I mean, I'm busy watching the new oh, what is the name of it? The guy that did Green Room, the new.
You're watching Hold the Dark.
Hold the Dark. Thank you. And that's Jeremy the kind Stone of movie name. We are talking about, right?
Yeah.
Like those, they don't go to theaters.
Yeah,
that much.
It doesn't happen.
Yeah. Calling back to the right stuff and astronauts, Betty Grissom died, Gus Grissom's wife, and who also very famously sued NASA because her husband was killed in a horrible launch pad explosion fire.
It's really, of all of the early accidents in NASA history, that's the one that just terrifies me at night.
Like, yeah, they're stuck in the capsule in an oxygen environment with a fire going.
It's just horrifying. Yeah.
And then I wanted to read this because, hoo boy. So this guy passed away, which I had never heard of him, but he may have the greatest obituary I have ever read. And I would like to quickly read it.
All right.
In Wilmington, Rick Stein, 71, of Wilmington, was reported missing and presumed dead on September 27, 2018, when investigators say the single-agent engine plane he was piloting, the Northrop, suddenly lost communication with the air traffic control and disappeared over the Atlantic Ocean. Philadelphia police confirmed Stein had been a patient at Thomas Jefferson University Hospital, where he was being treated for a rare form of cancer. Doctors from his team went to visit him on rounds, discovered his room was empty. Security footage shows him leaving the building, but then the feed mysteriously cuts off. Authorities say they believe Stein took an Uber to the Philadelphia airport, where they assume he gained access to the aircraft. We have no idea where Mr. Stein may be, but any hope for a rescue is unlikely. Stein's location isn't the only mystery. It seems no one in his life knew his occupation. His daughter appeared shocked by the news. My dad couldn't even fly a plane. He owned restaurants in Boulder, Colorado, and knew every answer on Jeopardy. I talked to him that day, and he told me he was going out to get some grappa. Stein's brother had similar confusion. Rick and I owned Stuart Kingston Galleries together. He was a jeweler and Oriental rug dealer, not a pilot. Meanwhile, Missel Leddington of Charlottesville claimed her brother was a cartoonist and freelance television critic for The New Yorker. And it goes on like this. And Stein's granddaughter, Evangeline, claims he was a YouTube sensation who had signed a seven-figure deal with Netflix.
Jesus, this is some Frank Abagnale shit. This guy might literally have done the Catch Me If You Can with everyone in his life.
When told of his uncle's disappearance, Edward Stein said he was baffled because he believed Stein worked as a trail guide in Rocky Mountain National Park. He took me on a hike up the Lily Peak Trail back in the 90s. He knew every berry, bush, and tree. Nephew James Stein of Los Angeles claimed his uncle was an A&R consultant for Bad Boy Records and ran a chain of legal recreational marijuana dispensaries in Colorado called Casa Blunta. His niece said her uncle had worked as a contributing writer for Seinfeld and Curb Your Enthusiasm and was currently consulting on a new series with Larry David. Okay. Police say the volume of contradictory information will make it nearly impossible to pinpoint his exact location. In fact, the only person who might be able to answer the question, who is the real Rick Stein, is his wife and constant companion for the last 14 years, Susan Stein. They were unable to interview Mrs. Stein. However, neighbors say they witnessed her leaving the home the couple share wearing dark sunglasses and a fedora, loading multiple suitcases into her car. FAA records show she purchased a pair of one-way tickets to Rome, which was Mr. Stein's favorite city. An anonymous source with the airline reports the name used to book the other ticket was Juan Morford de Rode, which, according to the FBI, was an alias Stein used for many years. That is one story. Another story is that Rick never left the hospital and died peacefully with his wife and daughters, holding tightly to his hands. You can choose whichever version you want to believe or share your own story about Rick at the Greenville Country Club.
Oh.
How great. How great.
Amazing.
Yeah. I had to share that. It's
very
brilliant.
Nice.
Yeah.
Very nice.
Back to other more notable, more.
You're not closing with that? You can't.
No, I got more. That. Oh, sorry, that happened God. In the middle of the month, and we just go in order.
That.
I know, I should have. I know, sorry. So Carol Hall, who was a composer, and again for Broadway, wrote the music for The Best Little Whorehouse in Texas.
Okay.
William Coors of the Coors Brewing Company.
No kidding.
Invented the recyclable aluminum can.
Yeah,
the silver bullet.
I was wondering when that came into the world.
Yeah,
because like
that's
you watch
why
older
Coors,
movies,
yeah.
you see the weird like non
the weird
yeah,
pop
the
top
weird,
can
yeah,
the
exactly.
metal can. Yes,
yeah,
there, yeah,
yeah.
Also, it plays into our theme. So there's a Coors tie-in to Burt Reynolds, which we'll talk about later.
Holy shit!
But also, Coors was a very regional brewer, mm-hmm. had very little in the way of sales. He took the brand to number three behind Busch and Miller. Paul Allen, co-founder of Microsoft,
mm-hmm.
Also co-founder of what started as the Experience Music Project in Seattle and became the Museum of Pop Culture,
mm-hmm.
Also co-founder of Spaceship One, and then also a film producer.
Mm.
Produced the movies Hard Candy, Far From Heaven, died at 65.
Mm-hmm.
Dennis Hoff, who is a, by all his own description included, a pimp, owner of the Love Ranch in Nevada, which is a legal brothel in Nevada.
That guy.
That guy had run for, I believe, governor of Nevada, something like that, not successfully, or was in the process of running, was this sort of unabashed, you know, terrible person, whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But here's what I found amazing. Found dead by Ron Jeremy.
Wow.
So I feel like if you're going to go,
sure,
found dead by Ron Jeremy is the way to be found.
Yeah.
That's, you know.
I don't
or
know
not.
If I like the idea of Ron Jeremy
just
being the
stumbling
guy to
into
find
your
death.
No, I know. It's clearly like, you've made some terrible life choices, yeah, if that's what's on the table.
And
right?
Yet he was compelling enough that the idea of playing him in a film pulled Joe Pesci out of retirement.
Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Is he going to still?
No, that movie came out like 5 years ago. It's supposed to be terrible.
Oh, well, there you
yeah.
go. All right.
Yeah.
Danny Lehner, who is a film director, directed Dude, Where's My Car?
Yeah.
Started in stuff like Freaks and Geeks and mm-hmm. television, yeah. Directed Dude, Where's My Car? And then also Harold and Kumar Go to White Castle,
mm-hmm.
which, regardless of how you feel about the level of humor, was pretty much the first movie to normalize Asian and South Asian leading men
mm.
in comedy. And, you know, to this day is probably one of the only examples of it. So,
yep.
You know, hugely important. Again, died really young. It's
yeah.
been not a great month for that. William Shearer, who was a doctor, most famous patient was the actual boy in the bubble.
Oh, wow.
So he is the doctor that built that crazy enclosure mm-hmm. and kept that guy alive and all of that. Ray Montague, first person to design a Navy ship using computer-aided design,
mm.
also a black woman. So she is the Navy's hidden figure.
Mm.
Todd Boal, B-O-L, was the creator of the Little Free Library, which if you walk through any mm-hmm. white neighborhood, you'll see them.
Yeah, they're out there.
They're out there,
mm-hmm.
mostly in places that don't need them.
Yep.
It's a way to be charitable without actually costing yourself anything.
Of course.
Anyway, and then last and not least, Lisbeth Palm, who was the widow of Olof Palm, the Swedish prime minister who was assassinated in 1986, still unsolved.
Wow.
Yeah. And she was the only material witness to the assassination.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Maybe she did it.
Well, probably not. But anyway, that, as they say.
That was roll call.
It was roll call.
All right. Super. Please do let us know on Twitter or in the comments at Modern Superior if we missed someone that you consider significant for the last month. But otherwise, we're going to move right along, talk about a little Bert. I'd be remiss if I did not say, I think I said it in the last episode, but I'm going to repeat.
Yes.
This episode dedicated to my sister because she named her cat after Bert Reynolds.
Did she? Is the cat's name Bert Reynolds?
His name is Bert.
Oh, just
after,
Bert. Okay.
After Bert
But
Reynolds.
After Bert Reynolds.
Yeah,
okay.
And he's huge. Just like Bert was.
Is he?
Yeah, let's talk about Bert's life. So he's born in...
he's also posing naked all the time.
All the time.
Stretched born in, out.
Born in February 36 in Lansing, Michigan, although for most of his career he would claim to have been born in Georgia. He only corrected the record on that in the last few years. He was a football player in high school, went to college on a football scholarship, and you know thought he was going to play football for his career, but then he had various injuries, including a car injury, car-related injury. So he eventually retired from football in 57, and he was kind of just pushed into acting while at Palm Beach Junior College. He says he was given a lead role in a play after his teacher heard him say two words. That could just be the mythology of Bert, but that's how he claims it happened, and then he became a working actor. His first major gig on a TV show was on a show called Riverboat. Had you heard of Riverboat?
No, I thought Gunsmoke was the first. So
No, he did Riverboat for a couple years, and then, as you said, he joins Gunsmoke
yeah.
A few years later for 3 years
he was
after
the...
Dennis Weaver leaves.
Right, and he... Did they play the same part?
No. So he plays, this is interesting during the research. So he plays a half Comanche character on the show.
He played a lot of half Native people.
So that's
right?
the thing. He plays his half Comanche character on Gunsmoke. And he does, by the way, he does claim to have Cherokee ancestry on his father's side, just like famous Native Americans Johnny Depp and Elizabeth Warren. But he gets kind of put into like a garret.
Now we're going to get mail. Go ahead.
He gets typecast in those types of roles quite a bit from there for the
sure,
for the next
because
few
he
years.
Is palatably white and yep, can play those parts
very
without
white,
worrying.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, yeah. So he says when he finally gets Deliverance in 72, he says he's waited 15 years to do a really good movie. Deliverance is I didn't know this when I watched the movie. I only found this out like basically yesterday. That's his breakout role. That's when he becomes the big deal.
Yeah, if you look at the stuff before that, he had some leading man parts, but they weren't hugely successful.
Yeah, they weren't hugely successful. Yeah. So he's suddenly enormous. And, I mean, we could argue he's the biggest, if not one of the biggest male stars in American cinema in the 70s. Like
he is absolutely the biggest star of the 1970s in terms of box office. Yeah,
yeah, he's enormous.
Yeah, I think you could make a case maybe for Nicholson.
But that's about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
So he's in The Longest Yard. He's in Cannonball Run. He's in Smokey and the Bandit. He's in the sequel to Cannonball Run. He's in. He directs films. He directs a movie called Gator. So huge, just absolutely enormous in the 70s. I was not really, aware in the 70s. So I really didn't know Burt Reynolds till he was in his quote decline phase. It's funny now. Like, I mean, I don't think of anyone having a decline that only lasts like 5 or 6 years. Because nowadays it's like any star can just come back any fucking time. But back then there were these narratives of ups and downs. Travolta's another good example. So Burt Reynolds theoretically declines in the 80s.
Yeah, and I stepped in. I mean, I was a child in the 70s, so I was not seeing those films because they were. I mean, they're pretty accessible, but they are basically for grown-ups, right?
Yeah.
So I came at him from about 1980. Well, my first is probably Cannonball Run, but even then I was like not super aware of him because everyone in Cannonball Run is playing a parody of themselves, including Roger Moore as a guy who only says his name is James Bond but is not James Bond. Mm-hmm. And and then he very quickly goes into stuff like Sharky's Machine and stuff that – Burt Reynolds is the first person I remember getting consistently bad reviews.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I remember about him and not really understanding what he was – coming down off of because I hadn't seen any of those films. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So eventually, end of the 80s, he goes back into TV with Evening Shade, which is another thing I have never seen a frame of. And I did already mention that he was on two of the greatest television shows, Beverly Hills and The Golden Girls.
Yep.
But yeah, so he's back with Evening Shade. Does a bit of a career bump there. That's a very well-regarded show, as I recall.
It was.
And great. Yeah, and in 96, 97, he's in Boogie Nights and has sort of that quintessential 90s indie film experience, which, again, I've already mentioned Travolta, which is these young directors, Paul Thomas Anderson in that case, grabbing these megastars from the 70s who have sort of fallen into disrepute and giving them a substantial role that theoretically relaunches their career.
Yeah.
I wouldn't say that Burt Reynolds was particularly relevant in films in the zeros and the tens, but he's made a film here or there. Apparently, I didn't get a chance to see it, but apparently one of his last movies called The Last Movie Star, which came out last year, is quite good. He died of a heart attack in September, and that's Burt.
Yeah. So where should we start? Do you want to talk a little bit about him overall, or you want to go right into the films?
Well, give me some more overall, man.
Do think it's interesting. Like, I think, and I don't think the movie I watched disabused me of this notion. I think the one thing about Burt Reynolds that maybe less respectable at the time, but now that I feel quite strongly is a good thing, is that he generally didn't do movies because he thought they would be, or at least my impression is that he didn't do movies because he always thought they would be good. He did them because he thought he would have fun doing them. And so, I think the part of his career that I stepped into as a regular film goer, which was kind of early to mid 80s, was the only time that I think, at least from my perception, that it seemed like he was chasing the idea of being successful. So he made a lot of things like Sharky's Machine and Stick. They seem like he's trying to be Stallone, like he's trying to make tough guy movies about himself, which is not, if you look at the stuff where he's really great, that's not who he is at all, and so they feel like mistakes in the sense that they're too needy, you know, or too craving a hit. Like, and they're just not playing to his strengths, which are about sort of quiet charm. The thing that I love about the movie I watched is that it's just a hangout movie.
Yeah.
Like, there's a plot, but not really. Like, it's really just a time to hang out with him and his friends and, like, enjoy their company. And Smokey the Bandit, too. And the Coors tie-in is the plot of Smokey and the Bandit is that Coors is not available in the eastern half of the country, and a millionaire will pay a huge amount of money if someone can drive a truckload of Coors to his football game for a celebration, because no one can get Coors, and it's considered to be superior. So that's what they're bringing in Smoking the Bandit. They're bringing a truckload full of Coors beer.
Now you're making me think I actually haven't seen Smokey and the Bandit. Like, maybe I got it confused with Cannonball Run and Cannonball Run
Very
too.
Possibly. So, and all of them are kind of similar, right?
Yeah.
And the other thing I was looking at is whether Smokey and the Bandit had any direct relationship to the Dukes of Hazzard. But it doesn't. It's interesting. It doesn't. But they do seem like they're cut from the same cloth.
Sure.
Like, you know, the whole, in Smoking the Bandit, he's driving the lookout car, which is this sport, this Firebird sports car. And the idea is that he's supposed to draw the police's attention away from the truck by speeding, but being so fast they can't catch him.
Right.
Yeah.
So is he Smokey or is he the Bandit?
He's the Bandit.
All right.
Smokey is what they call the police because they wear those Smokey the Bear style state trooper hats.
Got it. No, then I definitely need to watch that movie.
It is great.
You know?
Yeah, but it is. Yeah. But yeah, so I feel like I caught him in that decline of, like, those movies feel like, even if they're good, they feel like they're not necessarily Burt Reynolds movies, right?
And I mean, one of my main pet peeves with people who talk about movies, which includes us, but also most of our friends, is sort of this weird preeminent belief that the starting principle for everybody making a movie is that the reason they're making it is that they think it's good.
Absolutely.
And it's just like, first of all, even if that were true, no one can predict whether something is actually going to be good.
Right.
But even that, that's obviously also not true, right? Like, I mean, you have to think of making a movie for these people as taking a job, and you would take a job for a variety of reasons. Yes, some of them pay very well. That's a very good reason to take a job. If you need money, you take a job that pays
and
well.
One of the reasons is because you like everybody making the movie.
Yeah, you want to hang out with some fun people.
And
it's going to be made in an interesting place.
Right. And, you know? And so the two things I learned about, so the one thing is that he had this great friendship with Hal Needham, who he met as a stunt coordinator, and who he just said, look, if you're going to make films, I'll be with you. And that's where Smokey the Bandit and Hooper come from.
Yeah.
And Smokey, which is Needham's debut, there was no script, really. Like, the whole movie is pretty much just improvised.
Yeah.
And apparently everything Jackie Gleason is doing is improvised. So, you know, he just signed on again because he's like, I'll hang out with my friend. That sounds great.
Yeah.
Are we going to drive cars? Terrific.
Yeah.
You know? And that's okay.
Yeah, man. That's fine.
You know, that's okay.
That's a pleasurable way to pass some time.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mean, so, like, maybe we talk about, use that as a way to go into Hooper, because that movie is not a great film.
No, but
it's sure as shit a lot of fun.
It's a great hanging out movie.
Yeah, man.
Yeah.
That movie is just fun to watch.
Yeah, it is. It is. It has, there's a bar fight in it that is absolutely not believable and so much fun.
No.
So much fun that is clearly them going, we should just stage a big bar fight.
Yeah.
Is there a good reason for it? Nah, let's make one up.
Yep.
You know?
Yeah.
You guys are being too loud.
Yeah.
That's the reason that everyone in the bar fights.
Yeah.
You guys are being too loud.
Yeah.
You know, yeah.
And I like that. I like that idea. I like that this movie about a stunt guy very obviously is not even going to attempt to give you insight into what is actually involved in making a film. It's like most people who see this movie have no idea how movies are made. We're just going to lean into that.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
What the fuck do we care if they don't know about editing and different camera angles and multiple takes and all that
shit?
Yeah. Like, this is, I mean, I might be misremembering because I saw a lot of Burt Reynolds movies in a short span of time when I saw Hooper, but this is the one where, like, the last 15 minutes is him doing basically like a one take driving stunt through an entire burning
rocket
town, right?
Car driving stunt that involves a bridge coming down where they're just, apparently, they've just set cameras up everywhere.
Yeah, exactly.
And it makes no logical sense for how you would shoot a sequence like that. And what's really meta and fun about it. So the movie climaxes with this crazy stunt that quote unquote no one should do because quote unquote he'll die.
Yeah. Yep.
But what's crazy, the crazy meta thing is that in depicting this crazy stunt, it's very clear they didn't do that stunt.
Yeah.
It's all made up. Like, oh, yeah. Like, they didn't even attend. Like, so it's not like they did the movie going, let's show us doing this stunt that's so crazy. The stunt is faked.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
So, like, even on that level, it's sort of interesting to watch.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, that's what I mean. They're like,
they didn't build a rocket car that could cross a 200 foot gorge. No, of course not. That's
of course not,
ridiculous.
Because it would be psychotic to even try.
Yeah.
And I like the, again, the fact that they start with the premise that the audience has no idea anyway. So
yeah.
We will stage this series of stunts and pyro effects and all these other things, and we'll film it. And those are all stunts. Those are all things we have to physically figure out how to do. But the plot point of jumping across the gorge isn't a stunt. It's a visual effect. You know?
Right.
It's just
right.
like, ah, fuck it. Then
but the other thing the movie, I think, does get right, and which is really refreshing, and you don't see it a lot now, is that, like, everybody takes pills. And, like, it's a very
–
it does feel very real in terms of – how people their approach to drugs and sex, like that all feels really real and grounded and great,
right?
For me,
yeah.
It's like I said, it's a wonderful hanging out movie.
Yeah,
you know,
it's a lot of fun.
Yeah,
if you can find it, it's hard to find. You were saying it was difficult.
It was
to
difficult
get
it. To find. It's not on any streaming services, and the DVD and hard copies of it that are around are not readily around, at least not in our city.
Mm.
So I had to borrow it from a friend. But it's totally worth it.
Yeah.
But the biggest thing I noticed, the reason I jumped to Dukes of Hazzard, is because James Best plays his sort of cohort best friend, and that's the sheriff Roscoe P. Coltrane from Dukes of Hazzard.
Oh wow.
So and
another show I never really watched.
No, and it's not a great show, but it is, but again, it has this charm of, like, you know, the same charm that this has of just, like, these are fun people to hang out with. It's kind of ridiculous, but it's okay.
Yeah.
Let's
speaking about stunts.
Let's talk about Deliverance.
Deliverance, which it scared the shit out of me. And
it is terrifying.
For a variety of reasons. Yeah. It is a very upsetting, unsettling story. It would be alarming just on the premise of the plot. But also, having spent some time outdoors in my life and seeing how they're shooting those scenes, I am like, it is a goddamn miracle none of those four men died on those rapids.
Yeah.
There
yeah.
is crazy shit in those canoes that are done without wires, without CGI, without any. And I'm like, good fucking God.
Yeah.
Some of this stuff is bracing.
Yeah.
And then, like when they actually do, it is. I think we've spoken on the show before about, you know, obviously our generation has the postmodernism problem, which is sometimes we approach big moments in pop culture history that have been refracted to us in other formats, like Spaceballs for Star Wars or various jokes on The Simpsons for The Shining or whatever else.
Or for everything ever, but yeah.
I have heard a shit ton about the rape scene in my life. A shit ton.
Yeah.
I had no idea it was like that.
Yeah, it's awful.
It is.
Yeah, yeah.
Awful.
And it's not even the most awful thing in the movie.
No.
That's what's really impressive is you've heard a shit ton about squeal like a pig, motherfucker.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
But and that is absolutely, like, it is what's terrifying and great about that movie is how sad it is.
Yeah.
How miserable it is, right?
Yeah.
That the violence in it is of misery.
Yeah.
In an absolutely amazing way. Yeah,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I think I told you before we were recording that it is very rare when I am home alone that I am going to be watching a movie and make a lot of noise. And this had a couple of moments where I was just like, holy shit!
Yeah. Yeah.
One of them is when, at the end of the rape scene, Burt Reynolds shoots a man through the throat with an arrow.
Right.
Like, I was just like, motherfucker!
Yeah.
That is, holy fuck. And then, you know, I mean, spoilers, but then a later character is killed on the river, and what ends up happening to his body, which we can't visualize because this
is an
audio
show. One of the all-time
show.
Great things that has ever been done to a person.
Man.
Yeah,
yeah. It is something else.
Poor Ronnie Cox.
Oh,
yeah.
God. And Ronnie Cox is, I mean, they're all terrific. I'll get to Burt in a minute, but those four guys, you know, that, like, I've seen a good number of Voight films in my life. That is right up there with my favorite performances by him.
It is,
Cox is immense in this movie. Just a tremendous performance by Cox.
Yeah, yeah. And Beatty is
and Beatty's
always great.
Just
great.
Wonderful. Yeah. But I mean, the again, thinking about this now after the fact as his being his breakout performance, the only comparison I could make for Burt Reynolds' energy in this movie is Toshirô Mifune. Like, he is so, there is such an immense roguish
considering
danger
that
to him.
He's in the movie with Voight, who by no small measure is a huge deal.
Yeah.
After Midnight Cowboy.
Yeah.
You know, a huge deal.
Huge deal.
And also because this is a physical performance, which that's his thing, right?
Yeah.
To be in the movie with him and basically blot him out like Reynolds is the sun.
Yeah.
Like that's, you know, it's some fierce work.
Yeah.
For
it's,
sure.
It's really good. I mean, it's one of those things where like you see it and you're like, oh yeah, this guy is absolutely a movie star. Like just in terms of the charisma and the sheer command of sort of like, again, it is a physical role. The command of his body work in the movie.
Yeah. His naturalism and the always awareness of kind of how to lightly land a piece of dialogue without overdoing it. And that's why it's so disappointing to see his stuff in the 80s, which is very heavy-handed action stuff, because what you want from him as he ages is to basically go into, well, to get like Cary Grant, right?
Yeah.
And to understand that his role is to be, still physical, but dapper. And he never sort of achieved that.
Right.
And then even when he gets to his sort of comeback, it's about being ironically weird and not, you know, still good, but.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But still, yeah, I can't say it. It looks great. It sounds great.
Yeah.
And it really holds up. It is very, you know, I mean, we unfortunately did an episode last month where one of the all-time classics of cinema, I wasn't that into. But so it's nice when you see something that is that high up in the pantheon actually deliver
and
on.
Yeah, let's
what
be clear,
say.
They're very different.
I
accept that the
of
Blues
course.
Brothers is merely hilarious, but not
But I mean, still, it was a hell of a thing to see. So, thanks for dying, Bert. I guess
I don't know. That's a terrible way to put it.
I guess
I also want to say that in another way, there's a movie star he does remind me of, and that's Clooney.
That's a good way to,
in the sense that although Clooney is, I think, whether he's succeeding or not, he's trying harder to make films that are good. But Clooney has also created that kind of rat pack around him of people he likes to work with.
For sure.
And Reynolds did that with Dom DeLuise and Sally Field and, quite a number of others that just like were just people he wanted to work with. The other thing I found out, which I thought was interesting, because of course, Cannonball Run is the first time I ever knew who Jackie Chan was. And the reason for that, and I did not know this until doing the research for the show, Cannonball Run was produced by Golden Harvest.
Is that right?
Yes. It was a Hong Kong American co-production.
Wow.
Which is why Jackie Chan is in it.
Cool.
Yeah.
I had no idea.
And directed by Hal Needham. And Cannonball Run 2 is the movie where Needham started putting blooper reels over the ending credits.
Do recall
and
that.
You may know that that's where Jackie Chan says he got the idea. So all of those incredible outtake reels that have gone at the end of Police Story and these other Jackie Chan films, all because he got the idea from Hal Needham.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Anything else about Burt Reynolds we need to talk about? I don't think so. Like I said, I tried to watch a couple of his other movies. I just ran out of time.
Yeah, I think, I think he's just a guy that's absolutely worth revisiting. And understanding that, you should not go into a film like Smokey wanting it to be, artful. You should go in wanting it to be enjoyable. And it is very enjoyable.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Okay, well, we haven't landed on a candidate for next month's show. But
TBD.
We will post up the news on that on our Twitter feed, which is Death Watch Pod. You can also follow us on Letterboxd at Death Watch Pod, which is where we post lists of movies containing the person who has died that you might want to watch. The Burt Reynolds one is a lengthy one, so go give a few of those a try.
Yeah.
And obviously you can listen to all of our back episodes on the iTunes Store, on the Play Store, at modernsuperior.com, or anywhere that fine podcasts are made. That's not true. I don't think we're in Spotify. How would we be? I've never put us there. I'll think about doing that. Thanks so much for listening. Please do feel free to give us feedback. It has been 1 year. It's time for us to figure out how to do this correctly if we haven't done it correctly thus far. We appreciate your listening. That's right. Please get in here. Yeah. We need consulting. We appreciate your listenership immensely and hope that you have a great rest of your month.
This episode has been brought to you by the Modern Superior Podcast Network.